What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast number 123, Strength Training is Healthcare 2, featuring our special guests, Mike McKinney and Dan Boothby, both from Northeastern University. We were just talking with them briefly about the massive snowstorm they're having there. So if for some reason the power shuts off on one of them, it's because the snow just fell on their power lines or on their Wi-Fi. So I'm your host, Jeremy Jackson. Sitting right beside me is
Jose,
Shakira,
Gabby,
Jeff,
Olivia.
We're also joined by Dr. Josh Yellen from the University of Houston Masters of Athletic Training Program, and Nicole Kesha, probably three or four times she's been on here, and Sarah Strickland was on here last week with us with Dr. Knobloch. So they're here to learn and then to lend some advice, see what they got to say. So if you want to join our conversation, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, using hashtag DSMB. Matthew Bravo is over there on Twitter, so he'll be tweeting it up. And got a lot of moving around going on over there.
Sorry.
The Twitter for you guys is at GONU Performance, so GONU Performance. So if you want to hit up them on Twitter, Matthew will be tweeting that out as well. He should be. Bernice is on the Ustream social feature. Links to those are on our website at sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Without much further ado, Jose.
Mr. McKinney, please tell us about yourself briefly.
I'm an athletic trainer and corrective exercise specialist going on my second year at Northeastern University and my seventh year as an athletic trainer. I coordinate care for the men's ice hockey program and oversee clinical education of the athletic training students and preceptors at our facilities. Prior to Northeastern, I've also worked as a physician extender, high school AT, and a graduate assistant at the Division I level too. So I've done a variety of different settings up until this point.
Where'd you go to graduate school?
North Dakota State University.
Where'd you go to undergrad?
Gustavus Adolphus College.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right, real quick, Mike, how old are you, dude?
30.
30, okay. Because, I mean, you look a good bit younger than me. Maybe this is my bald head or something, but, and I mean, you've been through all of that. And sorry. All right, go ahead. We're good. All right, Dan, same question.
I'm the director of strength conditioning here at Northeastern. This is my 10th year at Northeastern. I've been the strength conditioning coach for our hockey program for the last 10 years. And I also have a private training facility just south of the city where we work with predominantly hockey players as well at all ages, but other sports as well, gymnastics, lacrosse, and just trying to apply the same philosophy to that private setting and having a positive impact on sports injuries.
Mike, tell me your background. CSCS?
I'm actually just through the NASM. I have my corrective exercise specialist, which is something I earned while I was actually working in the clinical setting to try and make up that gap between the return to play and the strength and conditioning, because that was what we were finding was a big gap in with re-injury rates and that sort of thing. So that was something I pursued along those lines.
Okay. And then is it Dan?
Dan,
what's your background? Educationally.
A CSCS, and then I have a master's degree in sports nutrition.
From where?
Northeastern University.
Where'd you do your undergrad?
Central Connecticut,
okay.
State.
All right. I got a good dose of hockey. I did my master's degree at Long Beach State, and so we worked with the Anaheim Ducks, and then we also worked with the Long Beach Ice Dogs.
Yeah.
So that was a great experience. Great experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Good programs.
Yeah.
My extent of hockey is I've been to two Arrows games and got to sit down on the front row and bang on the glass. That's my extent of hockey.
That was it, huh?
That's it.
Hockey players are a different breed.
Yes,
when
they
I
are.
When I was in Southern California, we were doing some work with the Ducks, and Paul Kariya came in. And Paul Kariya, from the waist up, looks like, I mean, he's in pretty good shape, but from the waist down, his quads were, we called him Quadzilla. He was just this massive, and he was so fast. So fast. So I have a really good, healthy respect for what you guys do with the hockey teams.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. McKinney, can you tell us about your program at NEU?
So our program at Northeastern University, we have about 16 varsity sports and 400 athletes. And a lot of the things that we do with men's hockey, we also do with all 400 of our athletes. To support that, we also have six undergraduate students from Boston University's athletic training program. 3 8-month employees and two residents that also pursue their master's degrees with us as well. So we have a pretty large staff to help take care of everybody. And I think it works really well because it allows us to get that individual approach to all of our athletes.
At Boston, you work with Mark Larson?
not directly with Mark Larson, but with his students through Chad Clements, their clinical coordinator. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Dan, can you please tell us about your program at NNU?
Well, I think what we've tried to do from the strength conditioning side is really understand that rehab is training and training is rehab. And I believe it was the British Journal of Sports Medicine just last year showed that appropriate training interventions can decrease injury rates by 40%. We've seen very similar numbers here at Northeastern. And I believe we've built a system that helps us evaluate our athletes, their athletic readiness, by performing science-based testing, screening, really, grade out specific movement qualities in these athletes, and really to identify what stages of natural development are these athletes at. And everyone's at a different training age or different stage of that maturation process. And I think with the prevalence of sport specialization with these young athletes, we're seeing a lot of, these dysfunctional patterns that have been reinforced over years, through the volume or the repetitive movement or the intensities that maybe these athletes weren't prepared for it at those young ages. So we're just trying to identify what their current status is and then create specific interventions that address that need.
Dan, I want to go back to something you said. You're really engaging in some scientific evaluations of athlete movement patterns, et cetera. What are you using? Using the FMS? What else are you using?
We're using the FMS as, I think, our front line. Every one of our athletes is going through the FMS 3 or 4 times over the academic calendar. We're also using some of the Timothy Tyler research, hip range of motion, goniometer measurements, mm-hmm. but also some manual muscle testing, through adduction, abduction. Mm-hmm. We're using the opto source video and laser analysis, looking at coefficient of variance and power and contact time averages. Mm-hmm. We're looking for discrepancy there. We've also started using the Pro 2 breathing device, mm-hmm. which is something that helps us look at their max inspiratory pressure as well as their tidal volume. And we're seeing that low numbers in these areas are telling us that there's an issue with maybe the zone of apposition or maybe weakness through the anterior core, which is going to impact their aerobic capacity, their ability to produce power efficiently and repeatedly, and they're going to exceed maybe the capacity of that tissue and exasperate some of the dysfunction that most likely is present already before they even stepped on campus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to add on to what Dan said, so when they go through the FMS, and everyone goes through it, if we've got numbers that are really red flagging somebody or an injury or something like that, the majority of our staff is also certified with SFMA. So FMS will tell you there was a problem. SFMA will tell you what that problem is. And then with that, the Pro 2 and the rest of the movement, we can really individualize what everybody's approach is to rehab as far as individualizing for each athlete.
So essentially you guys are using the FMS as just a baseline test. Then based on the numbers that you get back from there, you'll go in, look a little bit deeper if anything gets red flagged, and you'll use some more sophisticated tests and algorithms and stuff like that.
Yep.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It sounded simple when you said it that way though.
Okay.
All right. So you guys briefly talked. You got 16 varsity sports, about 400 athletes. You got 6 undergraduate students from Boston. So what do these guys get once they leave your program there at Northeastern University?
So the students, the undergraduate students, they will leave as, athletic trainers through Boston University's athletic training program. And we're just a clinical site. We don't have them for their entire duration of their education. So some will come back for a month or two. Some will actually be here for an entire sports season if it goes over 2 semesters and that sort of thing. They're all either on AT, ATDPT, or other pre-health professions because we had some pre-MD and pre-PA students as well. And then our 8-month and resident positions, they leave with masters in whichever program they're pursuing. Our 8 months are generally applied nutrition, and the residents are pursuing a degree over at Boston University. Mm-hmm. They're on a different program.
Interesting. Students, you guys have questions?
Mr. McKinney, can you tell us about your philosophy regarding strength coaches, or Dan?
Sure. So one of the things, and I know this sounds like it's a totally dirty word in the athletic training community, is because they don't want us to sound like we're strength and conditioning specialists or trainers, so to speak. But I think what is important regarding our philosophy is the belief that we can't achieve performance without a continuum of care between strength and conditioning and sports medicine. So that understanding of strength and conditioning actually helps with the healthcare and treating the athlete. I think there's been a move away from that, which I think has actually hurt athlete care. Because if you think about when you're returning an athlete to a high level of competition, you're also returning them to a high level of training. They don't just go back from a rehab standpoint. So at some point that rehab goes from, you know, basic rehabilitation exercises to you are doing strength and conditioning. And by having guys like Dan in my corner and working together, we're able to do that at a very high level. Also worth noting is our strength and conditioning department is under the medical model with us. It's not under athletics. So we've been able to classify strength and conditioning as healthcare as far as Northeastern is concerned.
So I want to work backwards for a second. Dan, when you're working with athletic trainers and, you know, before that athlete patient gets to you, what do you want the athletic trainer to know, or what do you want the patient to be able to achieve before they get to you? And then I'm going to come back and ask Mike the same thing.
Well, we want to see them proficient in basic movement patterns, and certainly the FMS encompasses a lot of those movement patterns. So we want to see them at an appropriate score. You know, I don't think a 17 is you know, reasonable. That's certainly where we want them by the end. But when we have 18-year-old athletes coming in here, not all of them are going to be at a 17 score. But we want to see them able to, you know, hip hinge, squat pattern, possess lumbopelvic coordination through those movements, be able to you know, innervate through that anterior core so that we don't see them driven into extension. And if we have those foundational movements set, then I think that opens us up to a lot of the different exercise pools and progressions that we want to have these athletes perform.
And what do you want the athletic trainer to know about? You know, at some point, the athletic trainer is going to refer back to you and say, okay, you know, I've gone as far as I can with this particular athlete, with this patient, and I'm going to hand them off to you. What do you want that athletic trainer to know about what you're going to do, about your background?
Well, I want them to know everything, and that's not always the case. But I'm documenting everything that we're doing over the course of that single year or that 4 or 5 year plan that we've had for that athlete. I want the athletic trainer to be able to look at training loads, the selection or the different movement complexities that we've chosen for that athlete, so that we're able to look back over that training phase and see what outcomes have we got. Have we exacerbated some of the dysfunctional patterns that we knew were present when they came on campus the first day, or are we making good progress? And I think for us to be able to be completely transparent with not only transparent, but also to be scientifically backed for the decisions that we've made through that process, be able to present that to the athletic trainer along with the outcomes, then, you know, we're getting down to the true answers. Mm-hmm. It's no longer an ego-driven decision. It's what's in the best interest for this athlete, and, you know, how can we make sure that they're progressing forward? And there's a lot of different skills and expertise that needs to be applied to these decisions. And I think the transparency is important. I also think the understanding of what the goals of these progressions and different interventions that we're providing the athletes, what the goals are, so the athletic trainer can help support those goals through some of those rehab processes. And at any time during a training cycle, or especially in season with ice hockey players, we're going to see some of this dysfunction become exasperated.
Right.
And to be able to relay the information to Mike, make an educated decision, treat that dysfunction, and hopefully we can get them back on track as quickly as possible with minor disruptions to their training plan.
And Mike, what do you want from that strength conditioning coach, right? So the athlete gets hurt, they come see you, you're engaging in, you know, immediate care and therapeutic interventions, whether that's modalities or medicines, and you know, you're really getting that person back to where they can really be functional. And now you're going to hand that patient over to Dan. And what do you want Dan to know? What do you want that strength coach to know?
So what I want him to know is I want him to have at least, you know, a basic understanding of the injury that this athlete has sustained, because strength coaches, it's important for them to know that, because they know how to modify exercises appropriately to make up for these issues. So that way me and Dan can talk and we can get a guy back, say, into our strength training program, working at a very high level with just minor modifications. And that way his, let's say, energy system development doesn't suffer. So when he's orthopedically ready to go, he's not still, you know, sandbagging it because he can't, you know, physically keep up still. And also knowing that he can always, I always, you know, and Dan can speak to this, we talk a lot every day back and forth about, hey, who's got this injury and whatnot. And also, Dan can find things, and sometimes he sees things that someone's numbers are way down in lift, their single leg stuff is really off, and all of a sudden now we need to know, I need to take a closer look at this person. So it's also functions as another set of eyes if people are getting hurt. Now, Dan's not doing any diagnosing necessarily, but, you know, numbers are numbers. If we've got a guy that's all of a sudden down for no apparent reason, that's something I need to know about. And so Dan's able to pass that information along to me, and we have a really good open form of communication that way. And also, it really helps that Dan's worked in hockey as long as he has, in sports as long as he has, because he's got a really good understanding of, you know, where people are or where they should be when they're coming back to strength and conditioning. Because different than most universities, we don't release athletes back to coaches. We release athletes back to strength and conditioning, and that's a part of their release back to sports. Mm-hmm. So we kind of move that piece a little bit, and we're finding great, great success with it.
So it's really a stepwise progression that you guys are doing, right? So you guys have made some, I don't want to decrease the importance, but some arbitrary type steps that they need to be able to complete before they can return all the way back. And so one of those is, you know, obviously they've seen the athletic trainer, and the athletic trainer said, okay, I've taken them as far as I can take them. And now I'm going to hand them over to the strength coach, and the strength coach is going to work with them until we both decide that they're ready to return back to their sport. Is that pretty much what you guys do?
Exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And how do you all communicate, right? So the athletic trainer, I don't know, you know, you're using the Next System, Sportswear, you know, any one of these types of programs. But what is the strength, you know, Dan, what are you using? Are you a part of that system? Are you updating Sportswear documents? Do you have your own documentation that is able to get uploaded to Mike's data? Or how do you guys do that?
We actually have customized a Excel document with all of our pools and drop-down menus and things like that. So it helps document every decision that's made over the 5 years that our athletes, and we obviously have the co-op, so a lot of our athletes for an extra year. So we're documenting that through our customized program. But then as far as reporting, we're using the OneNote or Sportswear and just making sure that everything's documented. SharePoint is another way for us to just drop in information. And Mike have access to that, have access to the training program, the extra work that we might have prescribed a certain athlete, and hopefully create that transparency that we desire.
Okay.
What I'm interested in is how this co-op started in the first place, like how, you know, who came up with the idea or decided this is what needed to happen, and how was it kind of implemented that y'all started working so closely together?
I'll let Dan answer that question, since he preceded me when this whole this whole transition occurred.
Wait, before you get into that, Dan, how long have you been at Northeastern?
10 years.
Mike?
2.
Okay, gotcha. Go ahead.
I was very, very fortunate. When I came in, we were kind of in a transition period. We had Dr. Corrado as our team physician from Children's Hospital, and he, I think, worked with our athletic department, our university health services, and him and Art Horn, our director of sports performance, created this model, had our department, move to be under university health services, and then just help service the needs of the athletic department. So,
okay, wait, stop right there. I'm just trying to follow you. So you all, are probably very similar to what UNC Chapel Hill does, that if I'm not mistaken, athletic training, strength conditioning, sport performance is out of the umbrella of athletics and into student health. Is that right?
That is correct.
Yes.
Okay. Got it.
And that's Jonas down there overseeing that program.
Which, by the way, is a brilliant model because A, you know, you can make money, right? B, it really is where athletic training, strength conditioning, that it's really where it needs to be, out of the Department of Athletics and into student health, where you're really interacting with some other healthcare providers and you can really be independent, and that you provide, so you're contracted out to the Department of Athletics. But
absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I believe we need to have oversight over the complete care that these student athletes are receiving while they're here at Northeastern. And we need to make sure that not only are we promoting their performance, but that we're protecting their lifelong wellness.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the cost of athletic-related injuries later in life is very high. And I think quality of life and activity levels and all those areas are impacted based on the care that we provide. And, you know, not to knock sports coaches, but I believe that some of the decisions that are made are not always in the best interest of the athlete, but in the best interest of the team/coach who's ultimately being held accountable to wins and losses. And,
right.
You know, it's important that somebody's out there looking out for the athletes themselves.
And so when you're outside of that model of the Department of Athletics, you're not dictated by any entity from that department, right? The athletic director, the coaches, et cetera. You answer to student health.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And so that really gives you the freedom and the autonomy to do what you want to be able to do, right? And be able to treat the athletes and be able to make some real decisions in the best interest without having any sort of pressure from, you know, the athletic director, from you know, those stakeholders in that department.
Yeah, so just to give you an idea of how our structure works, since we're out of athletics, so Dan is our director of strength and conditioning, and then in my department, we have Ben Miller, who's our director of sports medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Over both of them is Art Horn, who's an ATCSCS, who oversees the entire sports performance department.
Mm-hmm.
And then over him is our team physician, and then over the team physician is the director of our university health and counseling services.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a brilliant model, and I think that more universities are going to go to that.
Yeah.
Not to mention, they start to see the benefit of athletic trainers and strength and conditioning coaches. You know, you can interact with intramurals, club teams, you know, university athletics. You can start to provide some outreach, sources for local high schools. I mean, once you move into that model, the ability to really engage in, you know, true sports medicine, strength conditioning, really, in my opinion, you know, explodes. So I think you guys are ahead of the curve.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, really impressive.
Have y'all seen any, like, an increase in, you know, back to play, return to play and all that, just because y'all are working so closely together with each other? Has there been a major difference that you've seen in that with the athletes' concern?
From what I've seen from my standpoint, it's not necessarily, especially with our situation, a contact sport is a contact sport, you know, injuries are going to happen no matter what you do. But a decrease in the chronic issues, the issues that just show up out of nowhere, the training issues that, oh, I hurt my back squatting. Well, why'd you hurt your back squatting? My movement was off, you know, that sort of thing. That's what we've seen a huge decrease in by, implementing these types of, screening methods that we've been using, because we've been able to catch these people before we send them to do, I don't know, something that'll put them at risk.
And do you guys have metrics on that? You know, based on the model that you all have, this collaborative effort, we've seen a decrease in, you know, strains, sprains. Obviously, you can't really control catastrophic injuries, but like you said, the chronic, more minor issues that become major issues. Are you guys keeping metrics on that?
Well, on the sports medicine side, what we do is at the end of the year, we do yearly reports for our individual sports. We produce those. And what we're finding is the chronic stuff starting to go down, and the injuries that are, you know, hanging around are generally of contact in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Dan, have you noticed anything from the strength and conditioning side?
Yeah, we've seen a 40% reduction right around there, and that's those are rough numbers because I don't think we're getting better with the process in which we track those numbers. But we've seen about a 40% reduction in soft tissue injuries. And then one of our sports that's been a little bit more successful has actually been our field hockey program, which when this model first started, I think we had 7 ACL injuries over the course of 3 years. So really one class. And then since then, we've had zero. We've had
really
3 games missed due to injury. I mean, we're averaging less than 1 game per year. And we've had 3 NCAA appearances.
Huge. I mean, that's a major, those are major numbers. I mean, not to mention, the athlete loses time, but the university is saving money based on they don't have to pay for surgery. The athlete is, able to participate there. I mean, that all goes towards success. Those are pretty impressive numbers.
I think Absolutely. We deserve a closer parking spot. That's for sure.
Say it again.
We deserve a closer parking spot.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You guys, I'm going to send a letter. You guys should have names on those parking spots.
Thank you.
For sure. All right, so kind of translating this to the high school, one of the things that I'm actually working on, I just submitted it, was a grant so that I can get me and the other athletic trainer here and one of the athletic trainers in our district. So all 3 of us would go to Vancouver this summer to get trained in the FMS. And now what I'd really like to do is, the first year we'll train or we'll assess people after their season, and that way they can work through the off season. Now we don't have a dedicated strength coach. It's really just the football coach kind of runs his own program, and I think he does a good job of running that, and he's incorporating stretching and functional movement type stuff. But he's not trained or certified there, so. I mean, I guess if you haven't worked in a high school, you don't exactly know how it works out, but we probably have somewhere between 800 and 1,000 athletes. And I'm really just kind of looking for some tips on how you guys might run this if you were in my situation.
So one of the places I started my career was in a high school similar size to yours. Granted, I didn't do all this. That was very early in my career, but I think it's one of those things that I think taking the FMS is the first step because it's, from an equipment standpoint, very affordable when you look at what is actually required to run the test. And if you can at least flag these certain athletes that to take a closer look at them and fix something, you're already coming out ahead. Instead of reacting to injury, you can be proactive. Prevention is such a large part of our profession. I think this is a step in that direction. One of the things that we do with our PPEs every year is we literally have the FMS set up, and as athletes come in and give us their paperwork, they literally go each station.
That's exactly what I'd love to do.
Yep.
So go ahead. When I would run my mass physicals in the high school, I would run it that way too. They basically snaked all the way around the gym, A, so I didn't lose anybody, and B, just to make sure it was completed properly.
I mean, that's a great orthopedic assessment. I think that's a brilliant model.
Yeah, and it's and I think if you take the FMS, I think the next step from that is actually to take the SFMA. I found that absolutely invaluable. That's pretty much changed the way I look and treat people because it gives you an instant test retestability. So you immediately know if your treatments worked and not relying on the athlete. Yeah, I felt a little better. You'll instantly know if that movement pattern improved.
So for those not in the know, can you elaborate on SFMA?
So FMS is fond of saying that, or the company behind it is FMS tells you there's a problem. SFMA tells you what that problem is. Hmm. So SFMA goes through 10 top tier tests, starting from the cervical spine all the way down to a deep overhead squat. And then based on which of those patterns are dysfunctional, have their own breakout patterns. So you can literally go down and they take each segment out. So it gets a lot more of a finer result. Now you can do that as well, but I think from a functional standpoint, the FMS I think is a good starting point.
I want to kind of piggyback off what Jeremy said. So let's just say hypothetically, I'm an athletic trainer at a high school, and I'm one athletic trainer for how many student athletes do you have, Jeremy?
Oh, we have about 800.
Okay, so I'm one athletic trainer for 800, and we don't have a strength coach, and my football coach is really the strength coach, but he only cares about the strength, of the football players. He can care less about basketball or tennis or golf.
Yeah.
And so if you're going to give some advice to an athletic trainer that is at the high school, What other certifications, add-on certifications, would you have? CSCS, CES, FMS? I mean, which direction would you go? There's so many options out there.
If you're going to move into the performance aspect, I would say either pursue the CSCS or the NASMPES, because mm-hmm. either of those are going to at least give you a more of an understanding of the strength and conditioning side of things. Now, this is where I think this is very specific, and a good segue to that is, it's the perfect example. That football coach doesn't care about movement. He doesn't care about injury. He just cares about strength. And so this is where that gap exists primarily in almost half our profession practices in high schools. So I think this is where there could be more to be made up with that gap. And that'll allow you to, okay, when you release them back to the coach, they might have already started that initial strength and conditioning aspect where, you know, when you release them to the coach, they're going to be okay. Instead of, okay, you finished your rehab, you're weight bearing, pain free, go see the coach for lifting. Mm-hmm. And then that's when re-injury rates start to get a little bit higher.
Dan, what's your take on that? So, you know, let's say again, there's some mandates that are coming down that every high school needs to have an athletic trainer. Unfortunately, not every high school needs to have a strength conditioning coach. And, you know, we're learning, or a strength conditioning specialist, we're learning how valuable the CSCS is. So now you've got a high school athletic trainer, and let's say that athletic trainer now has gone on to get the CSCS certification. What advice would you give them to make them most efficient?
Well, I think that our field in general has to become more proficient in anatomy. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges I see with strength coaches, is they understand, you know, movement at a gross level. They understand the goal of some of our higher end movements, Olympic lifts, squatting, benching, all that stuff. That's great, but we need to be able to break down anatomy a little bit more. And the second point to that is, I think energy system development or conditioning, we have to be much, much better. I don't think we should be called strength conditioning. We should be conditioning and strength, especially in these young athletes who they don't have the aerobic capacity, they don't have the alactic ability to produce these power outputs, recover from them, and produce them again. And I believe that the coaches who are working with them are really only focused in the lactic type of drills. And so we're seeing pH changes rapidly in these athletes. These athletes are perceiving, fatigue or alarm, which is driving them into more of these dysfunctional patterns that we're trying to correct. So I believe the overuse the chronic fatigue is one of the bigger challenges that we face. And it's very easy to create a conditioning drill, you know, with 30 seconds of work and, you know, 60 seconds of rest. Mm-hmm. But some of these athletes, if they don't have, proficient breathing patterns or the aerobic base, they're not really truly recovering from them. And if they don't have the alactic ability, then the efforts or the work that they're producing is costing them more than it should. They're overpaying for those efforts. And if we could just focus on those two areas, once we're confident in their movement quality, we can pick a mode of conditioning that's appropriate for any athlete. Mm-hmm. We can build that aerobic ability and increase that alactic ability. And if those two are where they're supposed to be, then those lactic efforts that we see all the time in sport can have less of an impact on these movement patterns.
So I want to build off what you were saying, right? When I was in practice, I'd have parents come up, especially with their high school kids. Parents would come up to me and they'd say, and this is along the performance side, what supplements should my kids be taking? What kind of food does my kids need to be taking? You know, what's going to help me, help him get stronger, bigger, faster, stronger, et cetera. I want both of you to kind of elaborate on that.
Can I jump first here, Mike?
Yeah.
I would say, and I get that question all the time, and the first supplement that I think these kids need to add to their diet is fruits and vegetables. Add water.
Yeah.
Add fruit. And here's a banana, here's a carrot, and a bottle of water. Come back to me in a month.
Exactly. And unfortunately, these are exactly that. They're supplements to the traditional diet right now.
Right.
And until we're getting the appropriate nutrients, I don't believe that the supplements need to play a big role at the high school level, certainly, and even at the college level. And so start with the diet, make sure that you're doing the right things from a nutrition and a sleep standpoint. And then if we still need to dial you in more, then we'll analyze your nutrient breakdown and make some suggestions. But you French fries don't count anymore. They're right off the.
And so when I was coming through, you know, I always prescribe to the breakdown of if you're a teenage athlete, anywhere between 13 to 18, I was going to say 1.5 to 1.8 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. If you're a college kid, I was going to back that off a little bit and say probably, you know, 1.0 to 1.5, just because I always learned that, you know, in college, you're starting to end that growth cycle. Where do you guys stand on that? What's your breakdown of protein to carbohydrate to fats, and how much water should be taking in, and multivitamins? Where do you guys stand on that?
Well, I can talk a little bit about the water part of things. Dan can, he's kind of smiling a little bit there. This is a research interest of mine, is that an electrolyte balance is, we always talk about, as far as when we talk about energy system development, you need to start with the basics of energy systems, and that's basically fluid balance and hydration. If you're down on fluid balance, you're down on plasma volume, and then you're down on stroke volume, and just it's a cascading effect. So you're never truly training ahead. Mm-hmm. So part of it is ensuring proper hydration. During sports, to be honest with you, as long as they drink to thirst, it's not that big of a deal. But the biggest part where athletic trainers fall behind, that we've done a pretty good job at, I think, is after sports, the 12 hours before they see us again, overnight and throughout the evening and things like that. And from that standpoint, it's basically returning to the body weight that they were at prior to practice next morning. Because sometimes I think that when an athlete tries to return to body weight, by the time of the next practice, they realize they're down, and then they just crush water. Mm-hmm. And it's just sitting in their stomach. It's not actually in their system. So if they're hydrated first thing in the morning or back to that weight, that's a better indicator. And of course, in a sport like hockey, football, things like that with high fluid losses, they also lose somewhere in the neighborhood, on average, 2.5 grams of sodium. Mm-hmm. Which if anybody's remembers, the FDA recommends 1.5 grams for mm-hmm. your daily intake. So these athletes are losing way more than any FDA recommendation will tell them to take in. So salt is not the enemy, and it's needed for proper fluid balance. So making sure that that's a part of their diet as well. And like Dan said, fruits and vegetables. Following that, instead of, you shouldn't have to supplement potassium, you can eat a handful of almonds and then you've got your potassium. So
I want to ask you, break this down for me, Mike, pre-competition, in competition, post-competition. Pre-competition, what kind of fluid you want them taking?
Pre-competition, they can honestly drink whatever they want, as long as they're focusing on drinking at least 4 to 5 hours before the competition. Okay. If you're focusing it like an hour before, you're already going to be behind. Okay. As long as they have sodium as a part of their diet, they'll equal that fluid balance. There's actually some good studies out there that show people supplementing with chicken broth mm-hmm. prior to exercise, but those are more for endurance related sports. I don't know how relevant they are to football and things like that, but and during competition, honestly, it doesn't matter. They could drink sports drinks, they could drink water. It really doesn't matter, because gastric emptying is delayed by vigorous exercise. So even if you say want to drink that big carbohydrate loaded sports drink, there's a high likelihood it won't even be in your system by the time the game's over. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a good article about that with men's soccer in the JAT a couple months ago regarding blood glucose levels with ingestion of halftime carbohydrate drinks. Mm-hmm. So, and then post-game, usually you want to start within 30 minutes of finishing as well, for obviously to start for glycogen stores, sodium replenishment, fluid replenishment, especially these high intensity sports where fluid losses are great. And then the important thing is that they keep drinking throughout the evening. Somewhere in the neighborhood of, it can take up from 4 to 6 hours for complete hydration to occur. Mm-hmm. So this is something that athletes need to be aware of, and they need to continue drinking throughout the evening.
And so, you know, you're going to give some just baseline advice to an athlete, right? What are a couple of things that you're looking for? Listen, I want your urine to be a certain color. I want you to be able to go to the bathroom X amount of times. I want you to, what kind of advice, what kind of basic feedback are you giving them?
So I tell them that obviously if they drink a ton of water really fast, your body's actually going to kick it out of your system and not actually utilize it. Mm-hmm. So I have them, like, I'll show them a water bottle like this, and I'll like mark off on it, drink about this much every 20 to 30 minutes, because that'll help get it into your system a little bit more efficiently, and your body's able to distribute it better throughout the evening. And when it's empty, you know, fill it up and continue the process. I tell them to watch their weight, and we do monitor weight and things like that with certain athletes, and so those athletes are aware of that. And also the urination thing. I think it's important for people to realize clear urine doesn't necessarily mean hydration, because I can drink, I don't know, I can drink a Nalgene full of water right now, and in 30 minutes, I'll have clear urine. That doesn't mean I'm hydrated. So it's important to have multiple clear hydrations over the course of a day, or, you know, light yellow to clear. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, water clear, but as long as it's not dark yellow, brown, that sort of thing.
Sure.
So what would indicate that you are properly hydrated? Like a full day's clear urine?
One of the sayings that used to be pretty popular was 3 to 4 clear hydrations before noon. But depending on when the athlete gets up, they might not have that. So just as long as they're regularly urinating throughout the day and their body weight's regular, particularly stable, that's a better indicator.
Okay.
All right. So real quick, can you hear me over here?
Yep.
Yes.
All right, good. I just switched mics, so I can manage some stuff. Josh Stone, he's a guy I've talked to twice. He's always questioning why. And one of the things that he said is, you know, as athletic trainers, we tend to push the water, say, drink more water, drink more water. But I think it's hyponatremia. That's where you have hyponatremia, mm-hmm. where you have too much water in your blood. So talk briefly about that, since we've been talking about taking so much water in. What are your thoughts there?
So this is where the sodium as part of your diet is necessary. I think they're in the process of changing some of our position statements, because they were encouraging something borderline to over drinking in some cases, because obviously, you know, a broad recommendation isn't the same for everybody. But what they were finding is there were some research studies that found that the primary cause of hyponatremia was over drinking hypotonic fluids. Mm-hmm. That also includes Gatorade, includes Powerade, includes, because they're all hypotonic. They don't have enough sodium in them to, you know, basically flip that equation. So I think even there was that high school football death in Florida or Georgia, I think it was at the end of this in August, that was related to overdrinking. Something that he drank something like 4 gallons of fluids, which is never recommended. So that's where you have to be careful. And that's why when you make recommendation of drinking, like, I don't know, 8 to 12 ounces every 30, you know, minutes or so, that's better than drinking gallons of water. Cause you know, the average sweat weight for a human is a liter an hour. So, it's really possible to, you know, over drink in that case. Mm-hmm. But pushing water is not necessarily a bad thing, because it's going to diffuse across the small intestine more efficiently. It'll pass actively, passively, and that's where the sports drinks come in, because they try to even double down on that a little bit with our natural physiology. But it's one of those things that we just got to be really careful about, it, because if we're like, okay, drink as much water as possible, try and maintain your weight during exercise, those are the things that cause hyponatremia. Or the biggest one's weight gain during exercise. So if you've got football players that by the end of, like, say, a 2-a-day are actually 5 pounds heavier, those are the cases that you have to watch out for.
Mm-hmm. Because you're just not able to move the water out.
No. And then their plasma sodium levels drop to such a degree that they might need to be hospitalized.
Right. Right. We see that in marathon runners.
Yep.
I'm going to pose a hypothetical here based on some of the experiences that I've had. One is I'm going to go back to the chicken broth, right? That you can consume chicken broth, which is right in the area of pickle juice. And then some more of your commercial you know, Gatorade, Powerade, and whatever supplements are out there. If you, not saying that you're endorsing one or the other, but if you were going to recommend fluid intake, where would you lie? You know, I've heard some studies that pickle juice is actually the best rehydration tool we know of over Powerade, Gatorade. But the reason why it sells is, and I would agree with this, is because it's gross.
Yeah.
You know, growing up, you know, I had a Jewish grandmother that would always push chicken broth, because that you know, that cures everything, you know? So where do you guys stand on that?
As far as the pickle juice thing, I don't think it's a great rehydration method. I actually had a study just published in the JAT this month about pickle juice and plasma sodium changes during exercise. That doesn't show a big enough difference, at least during exercise, where it could make a hydration issue. And I think there's some other articles as well that were done out of our lab regarding ad libitum fluid intake that are pretty interesting in that regard. If I'm going for a pure rehydration standpoint, I think I'll just go back to like the Ray and Johansson articles of chicken noodle soup, essentially.
Yeah.
Because if you
my grandmother was right.
If you can, it's high enough in sodium, and if you consume it as a meal, it'll stay in your system better. If you just drink liquid sodium, your body's going to get rid of it, just like if you drink a ton of water really quickly. So if it's attached to food, your body utilizes it better.
Dan, where do you stand on that?
Well, I let Mike take the lead on this because he's very, very passionate about the hydration. I've heard the same things about the pickle juice. Obviously, our challenge is getting the athletes to actually adhere consistently. Products that we've used, we use the right stuff from NASA, and I think that's a great product that has about 700 milligrams of sodium in it per packet, yeah. I think. So that's what we're encouraging our athletes to take post game. And another product I like from a glycogen replenishment, not during activity, but prior and post, is the Generation UCAN. Mm-hmm. And I think they do a good job of high quality starch, you know, a little bit slower breakdown and absorption. So I think if that's something that we're supplementing during the week, that's a great thing. We encourage the athletes to do that. And then I think the right stuff for post activity for the sodium loss, and then obviously a quality meal after that.
And so go back to something that I read, you know, after strength conditioning or, you know, after a workout, I read some studies where they said the best post meal ingestion or something along those lines was chocolate milk. Where do you guys stand on that?
I think the chocolate milk is a great option. You're not going to beat the price of it, and especially in our situation where you know, we have a lot of athletes, we have a lot of contacts with our athletes through the course of the week. So to give them, you know, a $3 ready to drink option is difficult. It's not feasible, mm-hmm. And so I think the chocolate milk is a good option, 4-to-1 ratio there. And for the strength training, I think it's something that coaches can certainly use. And not something is better than nothing.
Right.
We want 30 minutes, you know, post activity. We want to you know, get those carbohydrates in there, you know, replace the glycogen that we've used. We need the protein in there to help with that uptake. And so yeah, no, I believe that's a great option.
And where do you both stand on, you know, the commercial protein powders? You know, I know the folks that run the Taylor Hooten Foundation. I don't know if you're familiar with that story, but, you know, about supplements and steroids, and they've really investigated the types of supplements you should take. They endorse EAS because I think EAS does the most amount of testing. I've heard of, obviously, metrics. So you've got a high school kid, and going back to what you said earlier, Dan, you know, let's start off with fruits and vegetables. But you've got a high school college kid that really wants to start to make some gains. And Mike, I'd also put this in your corner too, that what kind of recommendations? We've already tried the fruits and vegetables. We've already tried the water. We're just not satisfied with the type of gains. Do you guys endorse any type of protein powder, protein supplements? Where do you guys stand on that?
I would encourage you know, some of our underweight athletes that come in. I like the casein at night, especially. So I think that's a great option. I feel, you know, we have some terrific dining services here. So the access to good food choices that our athletes have is maybe above average. So as far as proteins go, other than the casein, I try to encourage my athletes to, you know, eat small meals, always include a lean source of protein in there, a high quality carb and you know, a solid fat choice.
And do you take them grocery shopping? I know that there are some college programs that take their athletes grocery shopping.
We don't take them grocery shopping, but we do have a set in our dining services that they've used. They've had people like Bobby Flay in here for cooking shows, and they can videotape them and everything. So we actually offer this to our athletes, where we'll have one of the chefs from the dining services come in, bring the athletes in there, bring out a list of ingredients, you know, what as you see them in the store or in your shopping cart, and then make a meal, walk them through the steps of that. And but we also have some online resources where they can see what good shopping options are, or what good menu options are.
And do you guys have access to a sports dietitian where you are?
Yes, we do.
Yep.
And how big of a role? So if I were to ask, you know, we've talked about really the combination between athletic trainer and strength conditioning specialist and the different variations, CES, PES, et cetera. So now I want to include the sports dietitian in that model. How do you guys interact? How do you guys relate to this? What kind of communication do you have?
So our dietitian is actually under the University Health and Counseling Services. So if we have an athlete that we say, hey, there's a diet issue, it's affecting performance, health, any number of factors that diet can affect, we can actually just make that appointment through health services like you would for any to see any healthcare professional. Mm-hmm. And then from that regard, we're able to manage manage the problem appropriately and kind of just help them out from all different angles instead of just saying, oh, you need to go talk to somebody. Let us know how it goes. Like, we have the ability to actually be a part of that process.
And that person is in the communication loop, just like it sounds like the two of you are, that you, yeah. You all share records and are able to communicate. And it sounds like you have a real free-flowing cycle of communication. It's open, egos are checked at the door, and you guys are all there for the best, in the best interest of that athlete.
Yep.
All right, so I'm going to jump in here. Bob Marley, he's kind of an athletic training legend here in...
Also an incredible reggae.
Yeah, that too. That'd be, but no. the tall, bald, white guy that you see.
Hey, Bob, I hope you're listening.
Texan sidelines. That's Bob Marley. But anyways, he said being CSCS has helped him in communicating with coaches and designing strength and conditioning programs and rehab and identifying weaknesses in athletes during practices and games. So, Mike, going back to when you worked in the high school, you said... Now, tell me your timeline again. You worked in the high school and then you went to the clinic?
I kept some very long days. So I worked full-time in the clinic and part-time at the high school. So it wasn't like an outreach thing. It was, I would leave the clinic and go work high school. So I would keep periodically 12 to 14-hour days. I don't recommend that, by the way, if anyone's listening. That's a real fast track to burnout.
So you were saying you got your FMS and those kind of things while you were working in the clinic, and that was at the same time as you were working in the high school?
Yeah, so the CES I worked at was because, kind of like what Bob was saying, is we were noticing, so the doctor would come and say, okay, this patient's cleared to return to sport as far as I'm concerned. But what the doctors don't have control over is when they go back to the high school, what happens at that point? It's kind of, there's a lack of information. Now, some of that has... is a result of HIPAA regulations and stuff like that. Like, the doctor just can't call the high school and give this kid's information to everybody. So there's that aspect of it. But we were finding that we needed to expand what we were giving them on our end as a, from a therapy perspective, to help them. So when we do release them back to the high school, that they're in a better position. And that's essentially what we do at Northeastern too. And it's kind of interesting that I find myself here now. It's because that was something we recognized 7 years ago now. And now I'm working at a university that's our care model.
So Dan, before Mike got there, how was your relationship with the athletic trainers? Because I know Mike's really, y'all work really well together. And so did you have any of this, an athletic trainer who wasn't so much into the preventative care as Mike is? How did that work?
I've worked with some great athletic trainers here at Northeastern, and most of the time we're always on the same page. I think our care model is pretty well outlined, so we just follow the action steps that are there, and then you know, the results really dictate the intervention. But certainly there's times when you disagree with you know, athletic trainers, and Mike and I don't always agree. Most of the time we're pretty good. But you certainly I've experienced maybe some athletic trainers who are a little bit more resistant to you know, the constraints of it. I mean, you're following a checklist like you're jumping into the shuttle. You follow the list, and I think that's difficult for some people who may want some autonomy or may want to go through there. In most of the cases, I think those are younger professionals who are still trying to validate their experience or their expertise, or you know, you're getting this job long enough, and you just want the answers, and you want the fastest solution. So that's my thought.
And I think I don't think Dan's had the opportunity to work with athletic trainers that necessarily don't buy into this model, because every time we hire somebody at Northeastern, we make a great effort on our end to educate them through continued education, get everybody up to speed. So we're not just throwing somebody, say, down at the ice rink with Dan with no idea of what's going on. So there's a whole education process that's probably the first couple months of somebody's employment, where either myself, Art Horn, we're going through FMS, we're going through SFMA, we're working on all the methods that we use. So that gap it's not that big, and it works really well.
And at Northeastern, will you guys actually send them, will you pay for those certifications for them?
Yes.
Yes.
That's outstanding. Listen, you know, I've got two entry-level master students here, Nicole and Sarah, and you guys were introduced, and they're going to be getting into the profession. They have one more year in the program, so they're going to graduate in the spring of 2016. What I'd like to do is be able to turn it over to them and ask the two of you some questions about maybe, you know, appropriate certifications, routes, some future decisions, etc. So I want you guys to be able to ask some questions to these two experts here.
Well, okay, one question I had, going back to what Jeremy was saying earlier, for a school that may not be able to get a strength and conditioning coach, would it be more beneficial for the athletic trainer to be CSCS or for, say, the coach to have the CSCS certification?
I would say it would be more beneficial for the athletic trainer, because then you can pair it with that medical knowledge and it's going to be more effective. Because that means you're going to kind of wear two hats. And I know there's many in our profession that don't think it should be that way. But frankly, the reality is it is that way for a lot of athletic trainers. So at least you can help them. And like me and Dan have demonstrated, the positive effect that has on not only training and injury rates. Sometimes, again, with the coaches and having them with the strength and conditioning, there could be that conflict of interest where they're, you know, pushing the coach's agenda more than the medical one, which you're there to, you know, support.
I know at University of Houston, we, you know, obviously the strength and conditioning is under, all of us are under athletics in a way, but one of the teams actually contracts out and uses a dynamic sports performance, basically training. And there, one of them comes and does all of the conditioning just for that one team. So they're not under U of H at all. And I think they've kind of done that because the athletic trainer also has the FMS and all that he does, and they work together. But the other sports don't have that option or opportunity, or they haven't chosen that. So how would you recommend, you know, those sports being able to kind of use the model y'all are using when they're all stuck under athletics and the coaches and the athletic director and all of that?
There's a very simple answer to that, but it's also a complicated one, and that's numbers. Mm-hmm. If you've got the numbers, like Dan was mentioning, we've got objective data that you can show people. It's, hey, we started instituting the FMS, working with strength and conditioning in marriage with the FMS, and tracking this injury progress, the strength and conditioning process and injury rates have gone down. That speaks for itself. And especially if you are able to show that with an outside organization, you know, that depends on the university whether they'll go through with that. But if you have the data to support that this method's working, that's a pretty, pretty powerful motivator.
Yeah, we have some really good metrics on the athletic trainer in the occupational setting in terms of return on investment. But we really don't have a whole lot of metrics on the athletic trainer in the collegiate or the pro setting as far as return on investment. And that we implemented the FMS, we implemented these various types of systems, and you know, we had a decrease in the incidence of, you know, surgeries. We had a decrease in injury incidence of loss of time. We had a decrease in the injury of, you know, the incidence of missed class. You know, all those other things that a university or a professional team would care about. So I would agree with you on that.
Yeah. And the other thing is, it's like sometimes it's hard to justify like a decrease in soft tissue injury, that how that actually saves the university money. But if that weakness and that movement pattern's corrected, you can make a really good argument that you prevented a non-contact ACL, and you can definitely put a monetary value on that.
Well, sure. I mean, not only this, but if you have a soft tissue injury and that athlete is a scholarship athlete,
yeah,
and they're not able to play because of that soft tissue injury, you know, essentially, I mean, I hate to say it, but it is what it is, right? This is the business of college sports. That athlete's a commodity. The commodity, yeah, is not able to perform. Why? Because there's some sort of, you know, hindrance there. We were able to prevent that. So you're getting a good return on investment in terms of scholarship athlete.
Well, and you see athletes who end up at a school for 6 years because they redshirted and then they did a medical redshirt and then they did their 4 years. And so then, especially if the university's paying for any of that, that's 6 years of eligibility they're paying for versus four, yeah, as well.
What are the questions you guys have?
You said, Mike, that you did the physician extender. And
yes.
How did that play into like how you are now, how you're at that training knowledge and ability to work, you know, in that setting? How did that kind of help you?
So that gave me a huge understanding of what goes on in a physician practice and from the surgical side of sports injury or just the orthopedic side of sports injury, because I worked for 11 orthopedic surgeons. So every specialty that you have orthopedically, they would treat. Sometimes I think not a lot of athletic trainers have an understanding of injury in that regards because they don't see that. So whereas opposed to some athletic trainers might see an ACL once, maybe twice a year, I saw 9 every Monday. Mm-hmm. So it gives you a much better evaluative skill. I think that I wouldn't have had if I didn't do that. Plus, physicians are walking encyclopedias in their respective fields. So you learn quite a bit about injury, the surgeries they're performing. And since my role as a physician extender was to provide rehab for these patients, not act as a medical assistant necessarily. So I was rehabbing all these post-operative cases. And so it gave me a much deeper understanding. So when these cases come up, you know, later in my career, it's just another day at the office. It's not, you know, the panic that I haven't seen one of these in 7 years. I've seen so many of them. They're, you know, I feel very fortunate, you know, it's 7 years into my career that I can say that. I think I would probably have maybe the equivalent of 15, 20 years of experience with those surgeries by about year four in my career.
Mm-hmm. I think that may show how important in a master's program having clinical rotations with a physician extender or a physician is. How beneficial it is.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We've been able to be a part of already some clinics on the weekends and so forth, you know, to seeing high school athletes. And I think already it taught me, you know, some just, like you said, you know, that physician is like a walking encyclopedia for what they are. I mean, definitely the doctor that I worked with, you know, feels like he knows everything and he's, you know, very young. So I think it's huge. Is there a certification process to do physician extender?
Not necessarily. Some states require the orthopedic technologist certification, and some practices want that because that means you can do casting and orthotic making and other things like that. We didn't have that because our practice was quite large, and they had 9 cast beds and 3 hired cast techs if that's all they did. Mm-hmm. Our podiatrist had someone that made orthotics. That's what she did. So it wasn't necessary for us to get that. In some cases it might be if it's like a 1 or 2 physician practice, then you're going to obviously have to do a lot more. In some states though, you can actually be, what I've been told is you can be considered up to a surgical first assist as a physician extender if you have the proper training. Mm-hmm. But that varies by state. So I'm not entirely sure all 50 state-wise where that falls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In Texas, they have, it just escaped me, but the physician can give the athletic trainer
standing order.
Yeah, but it's called something else.
Oh.
It'll come to me later.
That's all I had. That's all I got.
Come to me later.
John was talking about this morning.
Yeah.
All right, so what's been the biggest challenge you guys have faced in...
Sorry, delegated authority. That's what it's
delegated
called.
Delegated authority?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, there you go. See, I just had to start talking and then...
Yeah, that was it.
And you step over me, so sorry. All right, so what's been the biggest challenge you guys have faced in implementing this very tight relationship between the athletic trainer and the strength coach?
So my biggest challenge coming into this position was trying to get caught up with Dan. Dan knows a lot of information. He's been working with hockey and all our athletic programs within the system. So that's, I think, the biggest challenge. When you have turnover and new employees, you've got to get them up to speed with somebody who's pretty dialed in for the most part. And then making sure that relationship keeps being productive. And I wouldn't say it's like a challenge in a bad way. It's a lot of legwork on my end to understand what Dan's doing, to talk with Dan and make sure that we're constantly communicating and on the same page.
Dan, what do you think of, same question posed to you.
I think the challenges that we face is we're transforming the model. And I think for several years, for decades, you've had big personality coaches running programs dictating the environment or culture. And a lot of times they're using the strength coach. There's a reason why big football coaches, I mean, they almost always bring their strength coach with them. It's somebody they're comfortable with. They're their voice in those other settings outside of practice and meetings. And so for us to kind of take away some of the autonomy of the sports coaches, dictate appropriate care and, you know, return to play. And that's, I think, the biggest challenge. Gaining the support of the administration so that they recognize that these numbers translate to dollars. Mm-hmm. And it's the right thing for the student athletes. So I think we need to continue to collect the information that we need to do a better job collecting it, not just here at Northeastern, but our field in general, and validating the stuff, the work that we do daily. And once we have the support of the administrations, I believe that, you know, the coaches will quickly buy in. They'll have to. But if you look at the injury rates at the professional, at the college, and at the youth sport level, they're out of control, and something has to be done. The current model's not working.
Right.
And I do believe that this approach is the way to do that. It brings in all the disciplines in, you know, under that medical umbrella. It brings our profession up to snuff, and I do think that the strength conditioning needs to organize itself and make sure that there's appropriate practices that we're all following, you know, to develop strength in young athletes. That doesn't validate your program. So I'm really tired of hearing about, you know, strength coaches who market strength gains as, you know, an indicator of how successful their program is. Because if I took an 18-year-old athlete, didn't see him or her for 365 days, a year from now that athlete's going to be stronger.
Mm-hmm.
That's physiologically happening. That's natural. But if I can show improved strength gains and maximize that development process, and that's really all we're trying to do. We're trying to expedite the maturation process in these young athletes, develop coordinated movement, make sure that we're getting synergistic muscle intervention or innervation. And those same qualities that we're trying to expedite the development of are the same ones later in life that we're trying to slow the deterioration of. And so if we can promote quality movement, making sure we're efficient from an energy system standpoint, which again, I think is massively overlooked. And one of the questions earlier was, you know, at the high school level, what would you do? If I was an AT, I would get my CSCS and I'd learn everything I know about energy system and make sure that my athletes were the best conditioned athletes out there. Mm-hmm. Because fatigue is pain. That's what it is.
Vince Lombardi, fatigue makes cowards of us all.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. So from what I was hearing from you, Mike, and you, Dan, communication is, again, what's going to be the key for you guys working together. Dan said, Mike saying he had to get caught up with Dan. Last week, we talked all about communicating between the athletic trainer and the coach. What are some of the things that you guys have done or you might recommend to encourage that communication? Because it has to be really, you have to really understand each other. You know, Dan has to understand what you're doing, Mike, and Mike, you have to understand where Dan's coming from. So what are some of the things that you guys have done to build that communication?
So like Dan said, we have at the university something called SharePoint, which is pretty much a server run through the university that me and Dan have access to the same folder and we can put things in and out of it. So when we're looking at strength training programs and that sort of thing, I can see it. And I can make changes to it. He can make changes to it. One of the things that if you go up the GoNU performance dot, or sorry, the at GoNU performance, you'll see the picture across the top is at the center of our strength and conditioning and sports medicine facility. That wall down the middle is a glass wall. So basically, we can always see what's going on both sides, and it represents the fact that we're constantly going back and forth and talking to each other. So I think it's that communication aspect, whether it's by cell phone, something like SharePoint, Microsoft OneNote, even Google Docs on some cases. I think that'll help considerably in keeping that line of communication open. I think a lot of athletic trainers, especially younger athletic trainers, have a problem talking to their strength coach, whether they just don't want to deal with them, or like Dan said, they want to, you know, build themselves up as an athletic trainer and professional, but part of being a professional is working with other people. And so I think that's something that needs to be reinforced daily.
I think one of the successes of any young professional is the ability to build a team, right? And so to not necessarily being the one that knows everything, but being the one that knows how to get to the people that know everything. So as a good athletic trainer, you know, you're associated with good physicians and good strength coaches and good dietitians and good rehab specialists, and that you're able to say, look, I know what I know and I know what I don't know, and I don't know this. I've gotten you as far as I can, and now I need to get you over to Dan, because this is where really Dan is going to be able to get you the next level. And I'll oversee, I'll check in with you every once in a while and you know, make sure that you're doing okay. But I think a lot of the young professionals, I think kind of going off what you said, Mike, they want to be the everything to everybody, and you can't. Your ability to do really well, it's like a CEO of a company. That CEO may know a little bit about everything that goes on that company, but that CEO is probably not an expert in everything. But the CEO was smart enough to go hire the experts in those areas.
Yeah, agreed. Definitely.
Yeah. Agreed.
So if you were going to give some advice to these young professionals about being successful in athletic training, being successful in strength conditioning, what are three things from both of you that, you know, what are your pearls of wisdom that you'd give out to these young kids?
I think you said one of them when you were answering, you know, kind of talking about that, is know what you don't know. You have to know when you don't know something, and you can't fake it in this profession. If you try and fake it till you make it, it becomes real obvious very fast, and your patients suffer as a result. So knowing when you don't know something can actually be your biggest ally as a healthcare professional. I also think that constant pursuit of continuing education, not just getting your ATC and just keep that and don't work to improve yourself over the rest of your career. Unfortunately, I still see that a lot. Even people that I work, I've worked with in the past, that they get their ATC and they haven't pursued continuing education. And that's something I think that's why we're so strong at Northeastern, is because we have that constant pursuit. We're on that leading edge because of that pursuit. So when you come out of school, your resume looks like everyone else's. They went to school, they went to an ATEP. What else have you done? So that's the stuff that, you know, pursuing courses, maybe volunteering at a weekend event that is an educational event too, you know, those sorts of things. And I also say, I haven't been able to recently, but being involved with your profession, I think, is always something you should do, whether it's at the state, local, or national level, or even, again, by local, maybe if you host like a yearly sports medicine refresher between the ATs and your school district, not necessarily like maybe a NADA thing, but just something getting ATs together so everyone's on the same page and trying to review standards of care and things like that. So especially in the high school level, if you're going to another school or your athletes are going to another school where you can't go with them, you know what's going to be, you know, the standard of care at that high school. And likewise, they know the standard of care at your school when their athletes come to you.
Something that's really interesting here in Houston is that there's something called the Greater Houston Athletic Training Society. And I'm born and raised in Southern California, so I would compare Los Angeles to Houston. And I've never seen anything like the GHATs, right? The GHATs are all these local athletic trainers, high school and outreach, and we've been fortunate enough to get our program involved and get our students involved in that. And that's an incredible network opportunity, and it goes along with exactly that third point that you were saying. Dan, what advice would you give?
Well, I would reiterate both, you know, what Mike said and you as well, Jeremy. I would find mentors. You know, you don't need to know everything. You need to know where to find that information. And, you know, older professionals or professionals that have more experience, they can, you know, be very valuable. So if you can find mentors who are going to push you, hold you accountable, that's a great thing. And then, you know, again, be humble. You know, we don't need to have all the answers. That's not what our athletes are looking for. And I think we strive so much to try to be experts. And really all we have to do is if we've already established our mentors and our educational resources, then we need to be able to establish a rapport or trust with our athletes in order for them to adhere to the interventions. And that's really where everything gets bottlenecked. We can come up with the greatest plan, but you still need to motivate your clients or your athletes to adhere to that plan. And that's the part that takes the discipline and the, you know, the execution. So if we can be real with our athletes, outline these plans, bring in as many other professionals as you can to help contribute to that so that the athlete sees that. And I think that goes a lot farther than, you know, trying to create the perception of being an expert to the athlete. Being real is better than being an expert. And then I would outline, you know, your personal education goals. And like Mike said, you know, you get that degree and, you know, every time I think I know it all, I realize I don't. And I go back to the drawing board and, you know, everything has a place and nothing that I've ever learned has been thrown to the wayside. Sometimes something that I think is really important might be proven to be less important, but it is still one of the tools that I keep in my toolbox every day that I come in there. And I think you need to be proficient in a lot of those, but not necessarily don't have a favorite, you know, use them all. Mm-hmm. So those would be my three.
So I got one more question for you, and it's pertaining to what I do for work, right? As the director of an athletic training education program, my job is to be able to produce athletic trainers. And so what advice would the two of you have for all the program directors out there to make good athletic trainers, those that want to be able to combine AT and strength conditioning, and how to be able to change and keep moving forward with the profession?
I think one of the big things that this has changed even since I went to school was focusing on not just anatomy, but functional anatomy. So in taking that kinesiology or that biomechanics course farther, how this pertains to injury, how this pertains to healing mechanics and things like that, not just how joints move, but how this impacts the healing process. And kind of what we've gotten at with the functional movement patterns, what happens when these movement patterns are abnormal? Because that's where you're going to see the chronic injuries. That's where you're going to see the acute injuries are from abnormal patterns. So I think that it leaves the athletic trainer with less of a guess as to why the injury happened and more answers in rehab. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's a lot of information to cover. It's definitely not an easy answer. And it's also one of the things that with that I've been seeing lately is there's a big strive towards evidence-based practice, mm-hmm. but I've always been a fan of not sitting around till a study tells me to do something different, but taking what I have and using that. And then when a study comes out, so taking the information we have and pushing it and then slowly integrating more research, I think is something that is highly beneficial for students.
When I was coming up, and I think I told the students this yesterday, when I was coming up, we had the term problem-based learning, right? Experiential learning and problem-based learning. And experiential learning and problem-based learning has really kind of morphed into this evidence-based practice, right? That if we take this experiential learning and we really say, okay, well, what did you experience? What did you learn from it? You got to be really introspective. And then problem-based learning is, okay, now that you have this information, you compare it to other sources out there, what's the best way to solve this problem? That's really what evidence-based practice is. So yeah. I would agree with you. And also, I'm always a big fan of looking at the patient holistically.
Oh, yeah.
You know, your cervical spine issue may actually be coming from your ingrown toenail. So let's break it apart and let's look at chains and let's see where this weakness is actually coming from. Don't just treat the symptoms, treat the issue.
Yeah, we have a big focus on with our patient treatment, and this is a whole other podcast, to be honest with you, but with postural restoration and sympathetic response to pain.
Let me write that down.
Yeah, he's talking about like postural restoration. I'm like totally hunched over in my seat. Uh-huh. I'm thinking to myself, engage
compensatory patterns, a little sympathetic tone, but it's
squeeze umbilicus.
But what affects those patterns matters, and I think I think this is the drive towards patient-oriented evidence. What's the patient matter? You know, what do they think? How's this affecting them? So I think that's a really good, cause I mean, I hate to say it, but sometimes, athletic trainers need to realize we're in a customer service position because it's essentially athletes are coming to us cause they're hurt. They're not overly happy and they want us to make them better. So, knowing how to treat again, the athlete, I think is something that I think needs to keep going forward.
You know, when I was coming through, I had a mentor. And he pulled me aside one time and he saw that I was frustrated with the progress of an athlete. He said, remember, you're just a consultant. I said, what do you mean? He says, you know, that athlete is coming to you because they're injured and they want your advice. Now, whether they take your advice or not is a different story. If they take your advice, it's because they trust you and they have confidence in your ability to do your job. If they don't take your advice, it's because they don't trust you and they don't have confidence. So yeah. you're right on track that we're really in the customer service industry. We want our patients to be happy, but ultimately we're a consultant. Take it or leave it, right? You come to me and you say, what's wrong? And I tell you what's wrong, and, you know, take it or leave it. Right. Yeah. If you want my help, I'm happy to help you and guide you. And if you don't, good luck.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's for a lot of young professionals, that's a hard pill to swallow because they've worked so hard to get these letters after their name and they want to go out and, you know, puff their chest and say, look at me. But ultimately, right, you're a consultant just like any other healthcare provider is.
Yeah.
Right? I'm coming to you because there's an issue, but ultimately it's the patient's choice of what they want to do and what they don't want to do.
Yeah.
Great.
Dan, you have anything else to add on top onto that?
No, I you know, you asked you know, the area advice for the directors, and I think I'll just elaborate on you know, Mike's point. I think the anatomy is a big part, and I do believe the energy systems is something that both fields have to have a better understanding, because to restore proper movement patterns is only part of it. Then we have to build the capacity of that tissue and the resistance to fatigue. And it's easy to get someone moving well in the weight room or the training room when it's a predictable and repeatable movement. But when they get back onto the field and the court or the ice, and there's a level of anxiety there, you know, higher pressure and certainly higher intensities. Is that pattern going to stick or hold? And you know, the only way you're really going to help increase that or improve that is through the development of the energy systems, mm-hmm. and neural coding or sequencing.
A lot of big words.
Sorry.
That's why I didn't say anything. I just left it for you.
A lot of big words. I'm usually in my office making policy procedure. Are we meeting this competency? Are we meeting that competency? Bloom's taxonomy. These guys bring me back to. That's why I love it, man. I mean, this is my first love right here. I'm more comfortable in a clinic or, you know, on a field or treating a patient than I am anywhere else. But my job is to be an administrator and know all the different stuff. So yeah. Well, I can't thank you guys enough. I'm really jealous of the system that you guys have. And mostly I want to be up there when Bobby Flay's up there.
yeah.
I want to get some barbecue.
For sure.
Oh, yeah.
So I wish you guys the best of luck digging yourself out of that, you know, 8.5 feet of snow.
Thank you very much for having us.
Hey, this was great. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
All right, so I've got just a few more things before. David Young is in DeSoto High School, and actually Mike contacted me. He emailed me saying, hey, I'd like to be part of the broadcast, and so we set it up. So, you know, now we have Mike on, and now I'll probably have another episode with Mike talking about postural restoration. Go ahead. Fix it, Josh.
I'm trying to suck the gut. Right, I mean,
it's a good thing you can't see my posture because it's pretty bad.
Yeah, the gut. The core. Anyway.
All right. So
those are fat people problems. Sorry. Excuse me. Go
so
ahead.
Well, I'll make sure you're back so you can demonstrate.
Yeah, that's right. Here's what not to do.
So anyways, David Young said, he wrote me an email, and it was really good because I'm getting to the point where I was kind of like, I'm running out of ideas and this is a lot of work. And is this something I really want to do? And so, you know, just the email from Mike and email from David, really beneficial and encouraging. And so I'm going to read some of what he said. I just want to take the time to tell you how impressed I am with your broadcast. I have truly become a fan of your broadcast, and I feel it is an incredible way of letting people know who you are and what we do, who we are and what we do. Sorry. I also think this is a great way for fellow ATs to listen to other professionals and know that they are not alone in this rewarding yet difficult practice. I was so impressed with the first episode I ever watched, which is How to Run an Awesome Athletic Training Program, when we had the athletic trainers from Allen and from Dawson, that I made my staff watch it as well for the simple fact of listening to what others are doing around the state. So, David, thanks for your email. And anybody else, if you got thoughts, comments, if you want to comment on iTunes or email me there, all the contact stuff is on sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Dr. Yellen mentioned GHATS, the Greater Houston Athletic Trainer Society, and through that organization, you can earn CEUs, which there's a couple of people logged in today, so you can get CEUs for listening and participating and just hearing these experts and being part of the growth, and then also helping shape the future of our career with Sarah and Nicole here today. So again, my website, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, almost every single Wednesday. We're live next Wednesday. I won't be because I'll be presenting at a conference about podcasting.
Oh.
So, yep. So
what conference?
It's Texas Computer Educators Association.
Wow.
So it's in Austin. It's really just a ploy for me to go get some really good barbecue.
Right on.
Yeah, awesome.
Right on.
Got to do what you got to do, right? So on Twitter, PHS Sports Med is me at Go NU Performance. Is that right? Go NU Performance, right?
Yeah, at Go NU Performance.
Yeah, at Go NU Performance is the Northeastern University Performance there with Dan and Mike. Dr. Yellen, I can't believe you have not gotten a plug-in for the
website. I was just thinking about this.
For the website of University of Houston.
University of Houston Master of Athletic Training Program at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. For those that were so excited that I said it, I'll say it again. www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. Log on, see what our program's all about. If you're interested in applying to an entry-level Master of Athletic Training Program, we're happy to talk with you. So look us up again at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT.
See, I knew it. I was missing something. Just the whole episode, I felt something was lacking.
www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT.
All right. So that's pretty much it for Jeremy. The guys there at Northeastern University in the snowpocalypse. Nicole, Josh, and Sarah, that's a wrap.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you.
All right, guys. Y'all have a good day.
All right. Thank you. You have a good one, too.
God, they are just a wealth of knowledge.